Hey, Southern Fried True Crime listeners. This is Patrick Hines from True Crime Obsessed Podcast. And I'm so excited to tell you that I'm launching a brand new true crime comedy podcast called Obsessed with Disappeared. The podcast is an episode-by-episode recap of everyone's favorite true crime show, IDs Disappeared. So if you're as fascinated and terrified as I am by missing persons cases, this podcast is for you. My co-host for Obsessed with Disappeared is my best friend of 20 years, Broadway diva Ellen Marsh. Our podcast is full of humor, sass, heart, and also 2 decades worth of just the shadiest dirt on each other. So if you're serious about true crime and missing people, but you also love to laugh, find Obsessed with Disappeared wherever you get your podcasts. Episodes 1 and 2 are available right now.
Skip ahead 30 or so seconds if the resources I've been giving bother you. And thank you all for your support and encouragement. I won't stop. Here they are again. There is a crisis text line set up for those suffering from anxiety or depression. Text 741-741 for help. If you are experiencing suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK or 8255. If you are suffering from domestic violence, please call 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233. And please dial 911 if you're in immediate danger. Remember, you are not alone. I'll have international resources as well as these U.S. numbers in today's show notes. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Every breath you take, every move you make, every bond you break, every step you take, I'll be watching you. Those are the lyrics to the infamous song Every Breath You Take by The Police. It would be the band's biggest hit, though one of their least favorite songs. The Police frontman Sting wrote it as his first marriage was crumbling, and said in a 1983 interview, quote, "I think it's a nasty little song, really rather evil. It's about jealousy and surveillance and ownership." Indeed, it's about stalking and treating his loved one as his possession. And it is ironically fitting for today's episode. It's about an abusive, insecure man who stalked the women in his life, who treated them as if they were his property, who could not handle rejection. And he got away with it for a long time because he was a policeman. Welcome to episode 98, Every Move You Make, Double Murderer Elsie Underwood, Part 1. I want to open this episode by thanking author and retired Detective Sergeant and Chief of Police, Paula May, and her publisher, Wild Blue Press. Ms. May's publishing team reached out to me and offered her book, First Degree Rage, The True Story of the Assassin, An Obsession, and Murder, for use as a primary source for this episode. She was the lead detective in the murder of one of these two people in this case, and her book is an intimate look inside the investigation, and also shows her incredible empathy for the victims and their loved ones. I was so impressed with her writing and encourage you to buy her book, First Degree Rage. Also, in research, I watched old documentaries, and on the Forensic Files episode, I got to hear Ms. May's lovely Southern accent. She grew up in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains and then spent 30 years in law enforcement serving the citizens of the state of North Carolina. She is an amazing lady. I will have a link to her author bio and the sources for today's episode. And I will also have a special link for you to buy her book directly in today's show notes. On January 7th, 1994, Detective Sergeant Paula May was sitting at her desk in the Criminal Investigation Division of the Watauga County Sheriff's Department in Boone, North Carolina, when she got the call. Boone is the county seat of Watauga and home to Appalachian State University, where Paula May studied criminal justice and public administration. The weather had been miserable. It was 19 degrees at 2 in the afternoon, and the snow was deep. She was looking forward to leaving early to get a head start on the slick roads to home, but she was on call. A dead body had been found in the woods on the east side of the county. A land surveyor had stumbled across the body, or rather, the bare feet sticking out of the snow. The woods were above the Blue Ridge Parkway entrance of Highway 421, at the top of the mountain. Sergeant May hoped in vain that the body would actually be on federal property, under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Park Service and FBI. She went to the scene with another detective she supervised, cursing her bad luck. She had coveralls and snow boots, but from a crime scene the day before, they were dirty and soaked and were sitting in her garage waiting to be cleaned. She would have to rough it in her office clothes, slacks, and leather loafers. And as Sergeant May approached the body covered in snow, she knew it was in her jurisdiction. She would later find out the body was 39 feet into her jurisdiction. The body lay face up, but covered in snow. Only his bare feet stuck up through the recent snowfall. One foot was pretty much just bone, probably due to local wildlife, as his body was partially preserved by the cold and snow. She could clearly see the silhouette of a man beneath the snow. Paula's direct supervisor, Lieutenant Alan Stout, and their boss, Sheriff James Lyons, were soon on the scene. The sheriff said, quote, "Let's get the SBI out here to help with this one." He meant the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. They would help process the crime scene with Paula and crime scene technicians. When the special agent on call arrived, Paula shook his hand. She had worked with him before and thanked him for coming out in this weather so quickly. One thing I noticed throughout Paula's book is that she fostered great relationships with everyone she worked with. As a female, ranking detective, it could have been hard for her, but she had the sort of personality to command as well as collaborate. She was both respected and well-liked. She worked with the SBI to carefully remove small portions of snow at a time to reveal the body, practically by the spoonful, she writes, ensuring that they did not lose any evidence. They uncovered the body of a white man, dark-complected in areas where his skin had not decomposed. He had dark hair, and investigators spotted a bullet entrance wound on his left temple fairly quickly. He was completely nude, with the exception of an imitation gold watch and a gold signet ring with the initials RMR. As they carefully removed the body, they scoured the surrounding area. Sheriff Lyons spotted a strip of tape. It was several layers of black electrical tape and beige masking tape. On the inside, adhesive side, it was covered in black hairs and some blood. They noted a small hole surrounded by black powder. So the victim had been bound, probably gagged, when he was shot, and the killer had likely dropped this ligature, as no other clothes, tape, or anything else was found. Paula returned to the office and put out an alert for missing persons. With the snow and cold, there was no way to tell for sure how long the man had been in the woods. An autopsy might tell more, but she was still waiting for that. She got a call from the Salisbury Police Department fairly quickly. A Swedish man had been reported missing in mid-December. His name was Victor Gunnarsson, and he seemed to fit the description of the body. A Caucasian man, 6 feet 2 inches tall, weighing 225 pounds. He had dark hair, a dark mustache, and blue eyes. In a photo attached to the report, Victor is wearing a gold watch and ring. The Salisbury lieutenant explained that they believed the Swedish man had been kidnapped and explained to Paula about his past in Sweden. In 1986, Victor Gunnarsson was charged with the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. Supposedly, witnesses saw him drinking in a bar near the theater where the Prime Minister and his wife had gone to see a movie. Palme was gunned down outside of the theater as they left. The eyewitness to the shooting failed to pick Victor out of a lineup, but he stayed under suspicion because he had connections to right-wing political groups like the European Workers' Party. He was under telephone surveillance for a while, even after he was technically cleared. Victor always maintained his innocence, and he was cleared in the assassination, which remains unsolved to this day. But his life in Sweden was essentially ruined by the accusation. He was a pariah. He could not find work and was harassed constantly by Swedish citizens who still believe he killed their prime minister. He sued the Swedish government for the media attention that ruined his life and hurt his family, and with a settlement, he immigrated to the United States. Paula was intrigued, but the Salisbury lieutenant said, "Hold on, there's one more thing. Victor Gunnarsson may have been murdered for another motive that had nothing to do with his problems in Sweden." A former Salisbury police officer was under investigation. Victor and this police officer had dated the same woman, and the officer had been accused of stalking this woman. The lieutenant wouldn't tell Paula much more until they were sure the body was Victor Gunnarsson. The autopsy revealed that Victor had been killed by two gunshots, one on the right side of his neck and one on his left temple. It took almost a week to get his prints compared and prove it was Victor. So Paula had a dead body in her jurisdiction, but Victor lived in Salisbury, along with a possible suspect, a former policeman named Elsie Underwood. This was shaping up to be a complicated investigation. Salisbury is almost 2 hours from Boone, and she would need to work with their investigators. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Salisbury is the oldest continually populated colonial town in the western region of North Carolina. It's noted for its historic preservation, with 5 local historic districts and 10 nationally registered historic areas. It is home to Cheer Wine, a cherry soda made by the Carolina Beverage Corporation since 1917. During the antebellum period and after the American Civil War, Salisbury was the trading city of the upland area, devoted to the cultivation of cotton. It was also the business and law center of the county. Many houses and other structures were built by wealthy planters and merchants of this time. In the late 19th century, Salisbury became a railroad hub for people and freight transported along the Eastern Corridor. In the 20th century, Salisbury's economy changed into an industrial-based economy. The textile industry came to town processing cotton, and soon many textile mills operated in the city. Today, there are about 34,000 residents, 57% white, 37% black, with Hispanic, Latino, and Native Americans making up the rest of the demographics. In 1994, when Paula May would be traveling there for work, the population was under 25,000, with similar demographics. Once Paula had verified Victor's identity, she called a Swedish police investigator, who told her a little about Victor. Born in 1953, he had no history of violence. In fact, he was a notorious ladies' man. A lover, not a fighter. The investigator plainly told Paula it would not surprise him if Victor had been murdered by a jealous man. He was not known for his discretion and had affairs with many women. Paula would soon learn that Victor was known that way by Salisbury friends and the U.S. as well. But he is also described as an extremely friendly man. He was charming and magnetic, and he made instant friends with people he just met. He literally had friends all over the world from places he had visited. Paula and the SBI team would return to the mountain where Victor was found, many times looking for more evidence. But aside from that piece of tape and some hair found clumped in the snow, they found nothing. The hair belonged to Victor. There were no shell casings or anything else that could help their investigation. However, upon spraying luminol at the scene, investigators were sure that Victor had been shot there. The ground positively lit up, showing that Victor had bled to death in that very spot. Back at the office, Paula talked to a detective for Rowan County, where Salisbury is located, named Don Gale. She would come to work closely with him. He was the lead investigator in the murder of a 77-year-old woman named Catherine Miller. Paula remembers that even as he described the Catherine Miller murder scene, she couldn't really see a connection. Until Don told her that Kay Whedon, the woman Victor had been recently dating, was the daughter of Catherine Miller. Both victims were shot in the head, in what many cops refer to as a double tap. It's a shooting technique the military and police use to ensure the quickest death. Catherine Miller was a widow who had worked in accounting for the same refrigeration company for 40 years. When she didn't show up for work or call, her employer was immediately concerned. So her body, slumped pitifully in her kitchen, was found the morning after her murder. Catherine only had one daughter, and she doted on Kay Whedon and Kay's son Jason. Kay had been recently divorced and had carefully stuck her toe back into the dating pool. Unfortunately, it was with a man named Lamont Claxton Underwood, who went by LC. He was a policeman in Salisbury who quickly became obsessed with Kay, smothering her and then terrorizing her as she tried to break up with him. It had taken her nearly 3 years to disentangle herself from the toxic relationship. Don Gill told Paula that Elsie had worked for the Salisbury Police Department for 8 years before he went on disability retirement. Allegedly, Gill pointed out. Kay had reported Elsie's stalking of her to his chief, and the chief decided this was the simplest way to get rid of him. Then Don Gill warned her that the original lieutenant she had spoken with at Salisbury was a close friend of Elsie's, and he told her to be careful who she spoke with. Paula had sensed the lieutenant's reticence in talking to her, but thought at the time it was only because they were waiting for a positive ID. Paula, SBI agent Steve Wilson, and Don Gill would be working together in a joint investigation into LC Underwood. They dug up every person they could find who knew LC Underwood to shed light on his background. And they soon discovered he had a particularly bleak childhood. He was born in September of 1951 in Winston-Salem to parents Ras and Ethel Underwood. He had an older brother named Richard and a younger sister named Margot. Early investigations showed the Underwoods to be hard-partying alcoholics with little interest in raising their children. When interviewing Richard, they heard of a sad Christmas Eve when the Underwoods were fighting. He said, quote, "Both of them were drinking, I guess." The kids were upset and crying and fighting as well. And Ras got angry and locked all three of them in the barn for the night as he went back inside to continue fighting with his wife. The children spent the night shivering in the cold barn, and they were so young that they couldn't understand why Santa Claus hadn't come that year. The Underwoods were investigated by social services for neglect. And when LC, or Lamont, as his relatives called him, was 5 years old and Margot was 2, Ethel showed up on Ras's brother's doorstep with her 3 children. She begged George Underwood and his wife to take her kids. But George quickly found Ras and made him take the children back. He lasted about 3 months before he abandoned them too. George and Delzia Underwood were granted legal and physical custody of Lamont and Margot. 3 kids were just too much, so 6-year-old Richard went to live with his paternal grandmother. And Richard, out of the three, went on to live the most normal and happy life. He got an education and became a respected firefighter. Some family members said his grandmother and his Aunt Ruby, who lived with them, spoiled Richard. But it sounds to me they were just good guardians. Lamont and Margot were not so lucky. George Underwood was a sadistic man. When Margot was interviewed, she said he would hold her and Lamont up by their ankles as he whipped them with a belt. And he was particularly cruel to Lamont. For punishment, he would make him wear a dress and put a pacifier in his mouth and then make him sit on the front porch to humiliate him. George himself told investigators this, almost proudly. It seems that he found it funny. And he laughed as he said he had to keep Lamont under control and would often tie him up in a sack if he was having a tantrum. After 3 years, George said that Ethel returned and wanted to take her children back. She wanted to care for them. But he said Lamont hated his mother for abandoning him and didn't want to see her. After 2 more years, George and his wife sent Lamont and Margot to the children's home, an orphanage in Winston-Salem. It was on the advice of a social services caseworker who made monthly visits to the home. Other family members told the investigators that Lamont sobbed for days. He said he was sorry for being bad and begged not to be sent to the orphanage. But in 1961, he and Margot became wards of the state until they were 18 years old. Margot not only told about the horrors she and her brother suffered at their uncle's home, but also that Lamont turned cruel to her once they were sent to the children's home. He told her he hated her. He would hit her for no reason. She said he was just mean-natured. She said she heard stories at the orphanage that Lamont killed small animals. She didn't see it herself, but she believed it. When Paula asked Margot to describe Lamont's personality, she said one word, possessive. Lamont graduated in 1969 and Margot in 1972. They had often stayed for weekends at George and Dell's house, and they went to live there until they graduated once they aged out. Except that George threw Lamont out on the day of his graduation. Lamont was fond of his Aunt Dell, but he hated George in return, so he left. Margot married fairly quickly in 1973. Both of her brothers attended her wedding, and Richard gave her away at the ceremony. But she didn't have much contact with them until their father died in 1989. Lamont refused to come see the dying old man, no matter how much Margot and Richard pleaded with him. This was clearly a very broken family. Paula did track down Ethel, Lamont's mother, who had remarried and moved to California, where she had other children. She was willing to speak to Paula and said she was sure her story would be different than what Paula had heard in North Carolina. Paula outlined the rumors about Ethel being an alcoholic who had abandoned her children. Ethel was not surprised. She intimated severe abuse from Rass, Lamont's father, and pointed out that back then, domestic violence was a secret, shameful thing. A woman in her position could not just walk out on her husband and take the kids. She wanted to, but she couldn't. So she did the best she could by taking them to their uncle, George Underwood, probably not understanding that George was just as sadistic and cruel as Rass had been. Dell had always been a kind woman. Ethel had no idea what kind of life she was leaving Lamont and Margot in. And it makes much more sense than the salacious rumors about Ethel the detectives had heard. They knew from Richard and Margot that Rass had been a violent and terrible father, but not Ethel. And that type of abuse is cyclical. It shed a great deal of light on the man Lamont Elsie Underwood would become. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from one of today's sponsors. We live in a world where technology has allowed us to control our phones, homes, and cars with just voice commands. We can shop online without even getting out of bed. And yet mattresses have more or less been the same since the invention of sleep. We deserve better. Finally, the mattress has evolved thanks to Purple. The secret to Purple is the amazing Purple Grid. It's a patented comfort technology that instantly adapts to your body's shape and sleep style. I tend to be a side sleeper, which isn't always great for my back, but with Purple's design that adapts to my body, it curves with my spine instead of pushing against it like traditional mattresses. And it's designed with over 2,800 open air channels and naturally temperature neutral gel. As someone who tends to get hot when I sleep, this is a major factor for me when I'm buying a mattress. With Purple, you'll never sleep too hot or too cold. The Purple mattress is soft where you want it, but firm where you need it, and it's comfortably cool all over. This mattress truly does it all. And you can count on resting easy every night. Year after year, because the ultra durable Purple Grid won't sink or lose shape. Purple is so confident in what they do that every Purple mattress comes with free shipping and returns and a risk-free 100-night trial. Experience the next evolution of sleep. Go to purple.com/southernfried and use promo code southernfried. For a limited time, you'll get $150 off any Purple mattress order of $1,500 or more. That's purple.com/southernfried. Promo code Southern Fried for $150 off of any mattress over $1,500 or more. Terms apply. After high school, Lamont worked for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company in Winston-Salem after graduation and moved out on his own. He enlisted in the National Guard in 1970, leaving with an honorable discharge in 1976 at the highest rank of Specialist 4. And he dreamed of becoming a police officer. His brother Richard had actually worked as a police officer for 10 years before he became a firefighter. And one night, he caught his younger brother drunk in a car. He took him home, but said it angered Lamont, and it was the last time he ever saw his brother. He believed Lamont wanted to be a police officer because he, quote, liked to exert authority. He said Lamont was just a mean person, just like Margot had said. And Lamont had wanted Richard to recommend him for the Winston-Salem Police Department, but Richard refused. And it was understandable. He knew his brother's temper, and Lamont had already been arrested once. The details are murky, but the story is that two men showed up at his apartment to rough him up over how he had treated a girl he dated. He fired two bullets at their car. He was convicted, but only sentenced to probation. Then he was able to get his record expunged before he applied for his first job as a cop. This first incident was a harbinger for how Lamont treated women and how he reacted with confrontation. Lamont Underwood would be married three times, twice before he became a police officer. His first marriage was in July of 1973 to a woman Paula calls Karen, but does not reveal her last name. It's possibly a pseudonym. And Paula rarely uses last names when referring to the women in Lamont's life. It's possible all of these names are pseudonyms. Karen was very skittish and wanted nothing to do with any investigation into her ex-husband. She had a new life, and her husband and children knew nothing about her first marriage, and she did not want them to ever find out. She insisted the marriage had only lasted 3 months and ultimately failed due to a lack of communication. When specifically asked if Lamont was jealous or possessive, she refused to answer clearly, stating that they were not married long. She filed for an annulment in March of 1974. However, she did reveal to the detectives that she thought Lamont might be gay. She said it was just a gut feeling and then terminated the interview. In less than a year, Lamont met a college student named Brenda and quickly proposed again after a few weeks of dating. Brenda was only 18 years old when she married Lamont, and the detectives had a hard time finding her. Family members only gave up her phone number once the detectives promised to just call her, not to bother her in person. She said the marriage lasted 8 months and was vague about the details, as Karen had been. She was too young and immature, she said, blaming herself. She said she had wanted to hang out with her friends. And she said all Amat wanted to do was become a police officer. She did say she tried to encourage Lamont into reuniting with his family, but he had no interest. He told her he didn't want anything to do with them. Paula again felt as though Brenda was not telling the full story. After finding friends of the former couple, she learned her instinct was right. This couple had seen Lamont slap Brenda on several occasions. They said he was extremely hot-tempered and jealous. The couple insisted they both saw him abuse his wife and pointed out, like Ethel did, that domestic abuse was, quote, not the hot issue it is today. Lamont also apparently jumped around with jobs a lot. He was a reserve officer with the North Wilkesboro Police Department before he got a full-time job in Catawba County. He only lasted in Catawba 6 months. Witnesses said Lamont was reported to have severe depression and suicidal ideation over his failed marriages. But once investigators found his girlfriend during this time, they learned the truth. A woman named Jeannie described a possessive, jealous, and violent man. Once they started dating exclusively, he started accusing her of cheating. Soon she realized he had stolen a key to her house. He would just be there when she got home. When she put a stop to that, he would wait for her in the parking lot to berate her. In one of these incidents, after she tried to break up with him, he said, "I'll just shoot myself." Then he sped off in his car, and Jeannie heard a shot. She was horrified and ran after him, but he was fine. He eventually apologized for tricking her. There were more incidents with Lamont breaking into her apartment and becoming violent. After one, the neighbors called the cops, who left without even writing down their names. But the next day, Lamont showed her a police report that basically showed her to be responsible for the altercation because she was, quote, drunk and disorderly. Then he blackmailed her. He thought he could keep her because she would be so embarrassed if people found out. But Jeannie, with the support of family, went to see the Catawba chief of police. The chief told her that the report was written on one of their departmental forms, but Lamont had falsified it. It was completely fake. After this, she refused to see him, and he sent her threatening letters. One began, quote, "Jeannie, the damage has already been done. I have sent copies of that report to your personnel department, your mother, and your sister. You could have prevented all of this by coming back to me, and now you're going to hurt like I've been hurt, you damn bitch," unquote. Jeannie also gave his chief copies of the letters, but she had no idea what, if anything, the chief did about it. But by August, Lamont had officially resigned. When investigators pulled his records, the chief had put in writing that it was a mandatory separation and that he would not recommend Lamont for employment elsewhere as a police officer. Jeannie never spoke to Lamont again, but months later, she got a call from a woman named Patty, who asked if she had had any problems with Lamont when they dated. Jeannie filled her in, and then Patty said Lamont kept a list of people who he said had done him wrong. She told Jeannie her name was on this list, and she thought she ought to know. She further warned Jeannie that Lamont was still a cop. In fact, he was now a detective. I'm going to pause now for a final word from today's sponsors. For me, stress and anxiety can sometimes be overwhelming. I struggle to manage my schedule and even do just basic tasks at home. Are you struggling? BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states treating stress, anxiety, trauma, depression, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. The service is also available to clients worldwide. right. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. You can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it's easy and free to change counselors if you want to. And anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there's even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting BetterHelp.com/Southern. Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Southern. Getting in shape helps improve your self-esteem, but it's more effective when you build healthier habits that you can stick to. It's also about practicing self-care so you can feel better about yourself, which is really personal. That's why Noom is so great. It's a program that adjusts to your lifestyle. Noom is not a diet. It's a habit-changing solution that helps you develop a new relationship with food through personalized courses. Noom teaches you the psychology behind the decisions you make and helps you keep track of everything from workouts to logging your meals. Noom has one of the largest and most accurate food databases available, so you can track your meal habits, visualize portion sizes, and check calories at a glance. Noom has given me the ability to make healthy choices more easily, taking the anxiety out of meal planning. And I love the ease of using the Noom app. It's just 10 minutes out of my day to help me keep track of what I eat, find new recipes, and connect with the Noom community. Aside from a personal goal specialist, there is a whole community of Noomers cheering you on, all in the palm of your hand. You don't have to change it all in one day. Small steps make big progress. Sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/Southern Fried. What do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/Southern Fried to start your trial today. Again, that's Noom.com/Southern Fried. Lamont had gotten a job in Lincoln County right after leaving Catawba. Apparently, they did not check his employment record or run a thorough background check. Paula May said that the Lincoln County Sheriff was a good old boy, a quote, Andy Taylor type who basically made his own rules. She points out that the elected sheriffs in North Carolina are politically powerful and often autonomous. They hired who they wanted to and fired them as they saw fit. When she talked to the old retired sheriff, he was very lackadaisical about Lamont, and even seemed affectionate towards him. He said Lamont called him Pop. When investigators asked the sheriff if Lamont got into any trouble, he made light of an accusation that Lamont had spray-painted profanity on a girlfriend's sidewalk, but it couldn't be proven. Then he laughingly said Lamont gave way too many speeding tickets. Not good for an elected sheriff. Lamont's supervisor at Lincoln County was more forthcoming. He knew the Patty who had called Jeannie. He said that after Lamont threatened her and she broke up with him, he stalked her. He also pointed out that there was not a law against stalking at the time. This would have been around 1979. The supervisor said because it wasn't a work-related problem, he didn't make any disciplinary action against Lamont, but personally told him to back off. Investigators spoke with several former friends and colleagues who all told similar stories about Lamont and his girlfriends, and Lamont often lashed out at the men they dated after him. They said he was too physically aggressive with suspects under arrest, and a lot of them knew about his relationship with Patty. He had been extremely violent with Patty. Once, he had waited at the end of her street until she got home from going out with her friends. He called her a slut and said she was too drunk to find her apartment. Patty indignantly said, "That's not true," but he followed her inside her apartment, still berating her. She said after he was inside, he completely lost control and picked up a heavy potted plant and smashed it on the top of her head. Patty screamed and fell to the floor, and then he began strangling her. She would black out, only to wake up to him strangling her again. Then he took his .38 revolver and held a gun between her eyes. Even when he finally got off of her, when she tried to get up, He hit her with a kitchen chair all over her arms, legs, and back. He told her he was on call that night and would hear on the radio if she tried to call the police. She said she just laid there crying, terrified he would come back and kill her until the next morning. She then drove herself to the hospital, so there was a medical record of this incident. She had a concussion and two black eyes, one with broken blood vessels. She had severe abrasions around her throat and bruises and contusions from being punched with a fist as well as hit with a chair. She stayed home for a couple of days and then tried to hide her injuries, wearing sunglasses and turtlenecks. But she couldn't hide them from her parents. Her father decided to speak to Lamont Sheriff himself. No charges were filed, but the good old boy sheriff promised he would counsel Lamont himself. Lamont often called the women in his lives whores. He told them what to wear and who they could see. He wanted to control every aspect of their lives. His next girlfriend, Monica, he met in 1980. Like many other women, she said at first he was a perfect gentleman. It seems Lamont could pull off the mask of a normal man until he got serious with a woman. He had also once put a revolver to her head. Monica said she tried to break up with him, but she said he could be very persuasive. She's not the only woman in Lamont's life to say he would beg her back, claiming he loved her and that it would never happen again. But he watched Monica, stalking her, like he had Patty. She once went to buy groceries by herself, and when she got back, he called her and asked, "What's in the bags?" He said, "You live alone. You don't need 5 bags of groceries." When she asked how he could possibly know that, he said, quote, "I know every move you make." I quoted the lyrics of the song "Every Breath You Take" by The Police in the opening of this episode. That song didn't come out until 1983, at least 3 years after Lamont had uttered those chilling words. Monica eventually got away from him, though he continued to stalk her for a while. When she began dating her future husband in 1982, she came home to find the word "whore" spray-painted in red on the side of her house. Lamont often did this, like a damn dog marking his territory. His next girlfriend, Linda, even said he had spray-painted ugly things about her on the outside wall of her church. Each girlfriend and ex-wife always asked, "I won't have to testify against him, will I?" His next girlfriend quickly became his wife. Around the time he was dating Monica and then Linda, he started going by LC rather than Lamont. LC met a woman named Marcia in 1982. Like the women before her, she did not want to give details about her marriage to the detectives. She said neutral things, like they were just incompatible, and she made excuses for his temper, saying he was under a lot of stress as a police officer. By now, detectives had already heard about Marcia. She was a sweet woman with a lovely smile, but not necessarily a bombshell like Elsie often went for. She struggled with her weight. Other people told detectives that Elsie often called her a fat ugly bitch or a fat whore. They separated after 6 months of marriage, but then reunited. She told investigators she had learned not to push him, but she looked away when they asked if he was jealous, violent, or in any way abusive to her. She said after a long separation, they legally separated in 1992 and then divorced in 1993. She would be the longest relationship of his life, and he treated her like shit. He ruined her self-esteem, and she was afraid of him. And she knew he had girlfriends while they were still married. She even said she hoped he would become serious with one of them so she could get out of the marriage. And in reality, he did. He didn't divorce Marcia until he was serious with Kay Whedon. But Marcia could never say no to him. She said Elsie could always make you feel sorry for him, mainly because of his sad background as a child, but also because he complained constantly of back problems. She genuinely seemed to feel sorry for her ex-husband, and she admitted to officers that he had called her in December of 1993 after their divorce, and she agreed to meet him. She was afraid he was suicidal. He asked her to drive him to a particular house in a subdivision. A friend of his had supposedly left a table for him on the porch and he needed to pick it up. She said she did, but then they pulled in the driveway and Elsie sat there for a minute. He said he didn't see the table and told her his friend must have put it back inside, and then he told her they could leave. The friend's name was Wayne Whitman, and he lived next door to Kay Whedon. Marcia admitted she did not know about Kay Whedon at the time, but she did now that investigators were talking to her. She knew what Elsie was accused of. But on that December evening, she had no idea she had just helped her ex-husband stalk his latest ex-girlfriend. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Southern Fried's audio is edited by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. The conclusion to the story of double murderer Elsie Underwood will come out next week. It will come out much earlier than this episode. I did try to condense it into one episode, but I would have had to leave out so much detail that I feared I would diminish what Elsie did to all of these women. His final crimes are the culmination of these years of abuse. Don't forget to subscribe to Fetal Abduction, a true crime podcast. I played the first episode for you last week, but you'll need to be subscribed to Fetal Abduction to hear the next episode, which releases June 10th. And I'd like to remind you to come join my Facebook group. We share memes and have a lot of laughs. It's a really fun community, and we'd love to have you. Hashtag no shit asses allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm sorry, but I no longer answer private messages on social media. I manage 3 platforms, and it's just too overwhelming. But please, feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. And to the people of color who are outraged, traumatized, and hurting right now, my heart is with you. I am devastated by the murder of George Floyd. I'm glad Chauvin was finally arrested, but it's not enough. I understand why people are still rioting, and I'm glad to see people of all colors standing in solidarity. I pray you all stay safe and that they arrest the other 3 officers soon. We cannot even begin to heal until all of these officers are behind bars. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.